Well, the name of our series that we're starting today is on the first slide. You know what acronyms are, right? An acronym is where you take a bunch of words and you take the first letter and you put them together, and sometimes they don't make sense. So our series that we're starting today is YNGWWICT. You'd never guess who was in church today. Okay, can you remember that? You would never guess who was in church today. It's based on the first three chapters of the last book of the Bible, which is the Revelation, singular, the Revelation. And today we want to look at the first chapter, verses 9 through 20. Has anybody here ever played the game Imagine If? Okay, Herb talked about the need for imagination when you don't have slides. Well, there's a game called Imagine If, and it's based on a bunch of hypothetical scenarios. And the hypothetical that I've been thinking about this week is, what if Jesus visited one of our churches? Now, can you imagine if Jesus showed up today, strolled across the parking lot, came through the front door, and would you recognize him? How would you recognize him? What would he look like? And I imagine he would come through the door and he would certainly get a warm welcome. Somebody would hand him a bulletin. But what would happen after that? Would it be a matter of, okay, buddy, you got a warm welcome and an announcement and a bulletin, you're on your own now? Or would he be greeted? Would he be engaged? Would there be people who would recognize him? I wonder what he would think of us. We often think about, well, what would we think of him? What would he think of us? What would he think of our worship? Would he be impressed? Would he think, yeah, it really sounds like they believe what they're singing? What would he think of their preaching? What would he think about the activities that we're heavily invested in that are reflected in the pages of the bulletin that he received? Well, you might think it's kind of a silly hypothetical, but according to the first three chapters of the Apocalypse, the book of the Revelation, that happened. Jesus appeared among churches in the first century in Asia Minor. There were seven of them, and he was there. And he saw what they were doing. He observed what was happening in the churches. He commended them for what they were doing well. Sometimes we're afraid of Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible, like all he has eyes for are what we're doing wrong. But he has lots and lots and lots of things to say by way of commendation. I like what you're doing. Keep on keeping on. But there were also some areas where he wasn't entirely pleased. And what we discover is that the Christ of history and the Christ of the Bible isn't just a soothing, cuddly-like lamb who never pushes back. What we discover in the Apocalypse is that Jesus is not only the Lamb of God, he is also the Lion of Judah. And sometimes he shakes things up a bit. And that's part of what will happen. The Lamb will push back. I don't know if when you gathered today, when you came today for our gathering, if you were expecting anything beyond the warm, the cuddly, and the soothing. Is there room in your idea of God and of Jesus that if he wanted to, and I'm not saying that he will, but if he wanted to, that he could push back in your life? Okay, let me talk a little bit about the background to the book. Essentially, what I think is happening in the Apocalypse is that the church is on a collision course with the empire. And we're not talking about Star Wars here. We're talking about the Roman Empire. The church was on a collision course with the empire, and for a very simple reason. The Roman Empire demanded an allegiance of the church that it was not prepared to give, that they were not supposed to give. You may have heard the expression emperor worship. The official dogma or religion of the Roman Empire was emperor worship. They believed that their emperors, who were called Caesars, that was kind of like their word for king. They venerated them, and they believed that they were deity, that they were divine. And so they required of good, solid citizens that they would worship the emperor. Now, there were some compellingly practical reasons for doing this. For one thing, it was the easiest way for a city to gain patronage. And when you hear the word patronage, think federal grants. Okay, if you want the support and the blessing of the empire, and you're living in some far-flung city in the middle of Asia Minor, which would be modern-day Turkey, the easiest way to do that is to show yourself in favor of emperor worship. You might erect statues. You may have special festivals. And above all, you might have temples in honor of the Caesar. And if you did that, if you showed yourself not only as individuals, not just as a small collective, but a city as a whole, chances are the emperor would look upon you with favor, the empire would look upon you with favor, and you would get the patronage. Now, by the same token, if in your city there happened to be clusters of Christians, and if maybe the church was particularly thriving in your community, and you would not accede to emperor worship, and you gained the reputation of not being in favor of the emperor, well, they could withdraw the patronage. Now imagine if you lived in a community like that where the church, in fact, was flourishing. How do you think your fellow Roman citizens would feel about you? They wouldn't have warm fuzzies about you. You're kind of a blight to society. You're part of the problem. Because of you, they're not getting the funding and the support and perhaps the protection that they need. And you would be viewed as unpatriotic. Boy, what a terrible thing, eh? To be viewed as unpatriotic. Well, sometimes in the 21st century, I hear in the media the expression bandied about Canadian values, and I'm never quite sure what those are. I'm not quite sure where I will find those. Is there a book that identifies Canadian values? And if I subscribe to those values, I suppose I'm looked upon as a patriotic person. And if I don't, I'm not. That's how the Christians were starting to feel in first century Asia Minor. The church was on a collision course with the empire. They weren't giving the emperor his due, and they were beginning to pay the price. And there's all sorts of historical documentation for this. They were being punished. They were being shunned, and in some cases, they were being killed. It's very difficult for us to imagine what that would be like today, living in Canada. It's not quite like that. So the church was on a collision course with the empire. Secondly, we discover that the Apocalypse is a rather unique book with a unique style. If you have ever read the last book of the Bible, I'm assuming that it was difficult. And if it wasn't difficult, I'm a little worried, because I think you're missing something. It's very symbolic. There's lots of numbers. There are strange images. And it's not easy to make sense of it. It's hard to read. And yet, behind the images and the symbols and the numbers, there is a discernible message. And it's a message of hope. The purpose of the revelation was to describe, in fairly symbolic language, the end of the world. Well, you say, wow, that's just too far out. Well, it's not really that far out. I mean, how many books are there that are being written today that are pretty apocalyptic in nature? How many movies are there that are essentially about the end of the world? Why should it be surprising that early Christians would give their version of that storyline? And they did. And they showed the story of how how good triumphed over evil, the story of how God defeated the devil. And at the end of the story, there was this incredible renewal of all things, a new heaven and a new earth. And for those of us who thought that when we died, we would go to heaven and live there with God forever and ever, amen, we're rather disappointed because we discover that heaven comes down to earth, and both heaven and earth are renewed, and we live in a place like that forever and ever. So I suspect that in the life to come, if you take your sandals off, you'll be able to squish soil and dirt with your toes. It'll be pretty earthy stuff. It's a story of the end of the world. It's a story of how God triumphs over evil. The Apocalypse, as challenging as it is to read, promises a blessing to those who read it. And so I would say to you today that if you need encouragement and you need hope, why not turn to the book that probably gets more of a bad rap than any other books in the Bible, and read through it from chapter 1 to chapter 22, and be encouraged. even if you don't understand all of the details and all of the numbers and all the stuff about bowls and scrolls and trumpets, there's a great blessing to be had. Well, we want to look at verses 9 through 20 today, so I want to read that to you from the New International Version, and then I'd like to break that down for you. I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that is ours in Jesus, was on the island of Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. On the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, which said, write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches. And then he names them, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. Here comes the symbolism. Imagine this. It's very imaginative. We're not supposed to just skip over these sections. We're supposed to visualize them in our mind. And I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet, and with a golden sash around his chest. The hair on his head was white like wool, and white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp, double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. John continues, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and now, look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Write therefore what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later, the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. I'm not sure what that means. And the seven lampstands are the seven churches. I think I understand what that means. John portrays his message in Revelation as ultimately a message from God. And it's passed on to his son, Jesus Christ, who passes it on down to his servant, John, and then he passes it on to the churches. That's what's going on here. I understand that John has two basic ideas that he wants to present to this church living in first century Asia Minor that is really taking a beating. Life is hard. It's not easy being the kind of person in a society that really values Roman patronage and being the kind of person that when they tally up your lifestyle has the end result of the city that you're living in losing its patronage and you're being blamed for being unpatriotic. It's not easy living where they're living. And the first thing that he wants to say to them is, brothers and sisters, I am with you in solidarity. John is sympathetic to his reader's hardship. And we saw in verse 9 that John understands trouble. Why would John understand trouble? What does John know about trouble? He's just one of these fancy schmancy apostles. What does he know about trouble? Well, do you remember it said that he was an exile? He's living on a remote island. Think Elnora. No, not Elnora. But he's living on a remote island off the coast of Asia Minor. And he's there because of his faithfulness to the Christian cause, to the God cause. He's paying a price for what he believes. It's one thing to say you believe something. It's another thing to be willing to pay a price for what you believe. And John's the sort of guy who's willing to pay the price. So he knows trouble. He knows the cost of holding to a system of belief that is sort of out of step with his culture. So he knows trouble. And the other thing that he says is he knows waiting. He talks about his patient endurance. He knows what it's like to wait for God to act, and God doesn't seem to act. He knows what it's like to be in a jam and to wait and to ask for God to get him out of the jam, to help him, and nothing happens. You may know what that's like too. Perhaps you came here today and you kind of feel like, well, I'm in a jam. I mean, not the kind of jam that they were in, but there's trouble in my life. Things aren't unfolding as quickly as I would like them to. I'm not seeing God act and move the way that I want to. And John comes to his readers and he says, I get that. I know that. I'm experiencing that in my life. Think of some of the couples in our congregation recently who have been expecting children. Joy just gave birth. I think Melissa, I don't see her here today, but she's waiting as well for the day. And I'm sure her doctor, wise man that he is, has selected a date. Chad, you're back there. You guys have just had a baby, so you know what this was like. The magic date was picked. And you kind of, you know, you're waiting for it to happen. And then before the actual date, you know, your wife will complain that she has these, they feel like contractions. All I know is they're called Braxton Hicks. But that's about as close as I've ever been to labor. All of my kids were cesarean, so I've just read about this. But you're waiting, and it doesn't happen. And then you eventually get to the magic date, and it still doesn't happen. And now you're a day, or you're a day after, and it's just not going on. It's you're waiting. And truth be told, a huge part of what we do in life is wait. I've never had a course on waiting. I probably should have. Because we do so much of it, whether it's at the bank or wherever you might be, at Costco, or just waiting for the good God of the universe to give you what he said he would or what it seems in the Bible he wants you to have, and it doesn't happen. And John comes to his readers and he says, I'm waiting too. God hasn't acted yet. We're waiting for deliverance. We trust that it will come. And I think part of what John is doing is he's trying to appeal to his readers. He understands that it's easier to accept direction from somebody who's walked a mile in your shoes. Those of us who have parented, sometimes the project goes real well. And sometimes our kids, they kind of fall into the ditch like their parents did when they were that age. And it's hard. It's always a lot easier if somebody comes alongside of you who's parented and whose kids have fallen into the ditch too, and they come and offer you advice, versus the parents who nothing ever seems to go wrong in their families. You know, they graduate, they're, you know, valedictorian children, they go to college on scholarship, but you know, that's not what your kids are like. It's easier to accept direction from somebody who has lived through some of the trouble that you have lived, and I think that's what John is doing here. So solidarity, he's sympathetic with his readers' hardships. But now comes the second main point, and I think this is the really important one, but it's a little bit different for us to capture because part of the chapter reads a bit like science fiction. John says, I saw something. I had a vision. Now, I don't know about you, but when people come to me and they start reporting to me that they've had visions of the divine, there's a part of me that's a little suspicious. And it's hard to believe it, but John comes and he says, I have seen something, or rather, I have seen someone, and he is not to be overlooked, verses 10 through 20. And within that section, there's a couple of things that he wants to point out to his readers. First of all, he wants to talk to them about what I would call the proximity of Jesus. He wants to talk about the nearness of Jesus, verses 10 through 13. And I want to draw your attention to the phrase where he talks about someone standing among the lampstands. Now you say, what in the world is the lampstands? Do you remember we went down to verse 20 and John identified for us what the lampstands were? What did he say the lampstands represented? Right, the churches, the seven churches that he's writing to in Asia Minor. And this someone who is later revealed as Jesus, Lord of the church, he says Jesus is among the churches. When the churches are suffering, when the churches are waiting, when the churches are trying to do the right thing and it's costing them dearly, they are not alone. The head of the church is with them. Good leaders stay with the troops, don't they? Jesus is with them. The proximity of Jesus among them. That's the first point. And I know theologically that raises a can of worms because we understand that physically Jesus is absent. And yet before he left, he said, I will have a spiritual presence among you. And that is supernatural. And many of us here today have experienced that. But now he gets to the meat and potatoes, middle of 13 to the end of 20, and he talks about the supremacy of Jesus. And his point is, remember, they live in a culture where there are competing claims as to who is Lord. Caesar has this idea that he is Lord. And the Christians have this other idea that it's not Caesar who's Lord, that it's Jesus of Nazareth, the risen Lord. He's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You have these competing claims to lordship. And so John says, I want you to see what I saw. I witnessed a vision, a holy vision of the supremacy of Jesus. And Jesus used two time-tested techniques to communicate this truth of his supremacy. One was show, and what would the other one be? Show and tell. Irene's been to school. Show and tell. So the first one is show. And you have this description of a person that, like, you know, if you were doing a film, you would need a really good special effects editor to do this with CGI and stuff. But he shows a person who has an appearance. I know we all have an appearance. Some of us have a rather frumpy appearance. And this person has what we would call a distinguished appearance. And by distinguished, I mean it's the kind of appearance that commands your respect. Every once in a while, you meet somebody like that, you know, because of their eyes or because of their demeanor, maybe because of what they're wearing. You just sort of sit up and you pay attention. That's the kind of vision that he had of the risen Lord. Jesus' appearance commands respect. And I'm just going to summarize these for you. He talks about his impressive attire. Most of us today are pretty cash. You know, I don't think any of us are going to make the cover of Vogue magazine, but if you would have been here 24 hours ago, there were a lot of people dressed up yesterday. I even had a tie on. That merited a couple of comments from some people. People were in impressive attire. And here Jesus is in either royal or priestly attire. And it was impressive. And he goes on to describe his godlike hair. And I say that because it seems like John had been reading the Old Testament. And there is an apocalyptic book in the Old Testament, Daniel. And in chapter 7, he has this vision of someone who is called the Ancient of Days. And guess what color his hair is? It's white. I never knew that. I've always looked in the mirror and I've sort of... Apparently it's godlike, the color. It's white. And John describes this person as having godlike hair. And he describes his eyes. I mean, if you have bright blue eyes, that's enough to get my attention. But this person had, he describes it as blazing eyes and glowing feet. And his voice, it's like he compares it to many waters cascading down a face of rock. I take it it's roaring. I've been to a place just outside of Jasper where all of these waters come together and you just about need earplugs. Scary. And then he describes his mouth. This is perhaps the most fearsome thing of all. His mouth, he says, has been weaponized. And he's got this double-edged sword that comes out of his mouth. What would that be like? And then he describes his brilliant face. And I'm sure that we could, you know, go into all kinds of detail about this. But suffice to say, when John is given this vision of the risen Lord, and he begins, even in a preliminary way, to take it in, it so profoundly affects John that he's terrified. So much for a Jesus that is warm and cuddly like a lamb. John is terrified by Jesus' blazing, otherworldly glory, and he's out cold. He faints. That's what John tells us. This may not be the portrait of Jesus that I would have painted or that I would have appreciated somebody else to paint, but this is the vision that he had. And it makes me think about many of the hymns and songs that we sing within the Christian tradition and how often they fail to capture the fearsomeness of the sovereignty of Jesus. I know that Jesus has several faces, and I am thankful for that. My wife has several faces. And when I get on her bad side, You know, that's a face you don't want to see too much of. But she has other warm and tender faces, and those are the ones I really like. But often our tradition, it just doesn't do justice to this, right? One of my favorite songs, okay, We Fall Down. We sing that here. We didn't sing it today, but we do sing it. We fall down, we lay our crowns at the feet of Jesus. The greatness of mercy and love at the feet of Jesus. And we cry, holy, holy, and holy. Well, by John's metrics, that is way too composed. That's way too tame. John couldn't have done that in the presence of Jesus. Kind of interesting, isn't it? So what do we need? Perhaps a new generation of minstrels and musicians and poets to come and give us a more full-orbed, well-rounded view of, vision of Jesus? Like, who could handle that? We sometimes sing a song, and I'm not sure how the words, something about, we would see Jesus, or something like that. Maybe the words are a little different. Really? Would we? Would you like Jesus to reveal himself to us like he did to John? Like, that's just, wow. This was John's way of underscoring the incomparable sovereignty of the risen Lord. I think that's what he's doing here. So that's the show part. And then there's the tell part. Jesus has a distinguished appearance, but he also has distinguished titles. Some of you don't really care about titles. Generally here at the chapel, we don't care about titles. If you try to call me Pastor Weeb more than once, I'll probably mock you a little bit by calling back your title. Like if you're a constable or whatever you are. We're not really big on titles here, and I know there's a time and a place for titles, but John here does depict Jesus as describing his distinguished titles. In verse 17, he has a title. He says, I am the first and the last. If you look at the commentaries and what scholars have said, it's something like, I preceded history as we know it, and I follow history as we know it, and I am Lord over everything in between. First and last, I'm the Lord of history. That's the claim that he makes. And then secondly, in verse 18, and this is kind of difficult, he says, I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. He's Lord of the grave. That's not a warm thought, perhaps, but it could be. It could be if he has not only the authority to dispatch people to the grave, but also the authority to deliver people from the grave. Couldn't that be a positive? Couldn't that be a winsome idea? He is Lord of the grave. And so, the Lord of history, Lord of life, Lord of death, he describes himself. And against the backdrop, we hear the clamor of the empire demanding that its citizens affirm that Caesar is Lord. And they have the power to penalize you if you won't. And the Christian claim comes along in contradiction of that and says, no, Jesus, Jesus is Lord. Who is Lord? Caesar? Really? Caesar can rant all he wants, but in the end, he's merely a sideshow. Jesus is the main event. And I think Paul's readers knew this. I don't think John was coming along and really doing sort of apologetics, trying to convince his readers that Jesus was who he claimed to be. I think they knew it, and he's trying to encourage them to hang in there. Well, who is in charge of the churches? There is a message in the first chapters of Revelation for the church. Who's in charge of the church? And before he gives them a message from Jesus, he wants them to understand who it is that speaks. If we're convinced that Jesus and not Caesar is Lord, then perhaps we would pay attention to his counsel. Because some of the things that he'll have to say in these letters to the seven churches are really nice, and then some of them are just disruptive, whole life disruptive. And if you're not convinced that the person who says them has authority, then they'll just roll off like water off a duck's back. Are we clear? Are you clear? Am I clear? Who is Jesus? Who is Lord? Caesar or Jesus?